And you're very welcome back to the Greg Hughes podcast. My special guest today is a man who's left an indelible mark on healthcare and community life here in the Northwest. Mr. Michael Sugrue is a consultant breast and general surgeon at Letterkenny University Hospital. And as he prepares to finish his tenure there on March 12, 2026, we're looking back at a truly remarkable career. Originally from Galway, Michael spent 2 decades in Australia as a professor of surgery before returning to Ireland in 2008 to settle in Remelton. Since then, he hasn't just been a surgeon, he's been a tireless advocate for Donegal, driving research through the Clinical Academy Trust and founding the Northwest Breast Cancer Charity Ball. He leaves the hospital's breast care service in a much better position. But many of you will also know Michael for his life outside the theatre. He's an accomplished photographer, the author of stunning books like Donegal's Atlantic Way, and a man who's rarely seen without his 2 dogs, Muckish and Errigal. As he prepares for a new chapter of teaching abroad, we caught up with him just before he hangs up his scrubs. Now, as I mentioned in the introduction, we are joined now by a very special guest for this edition of the Greg Hughes podcast, and that is Mr. Michael Sugrue. Thank you so much for joining us.
Greg, thank you very much for inviting me here to have a chat with you. I'm really looking forward to it.
And we're talking in a different context. I'm sure we'll overlap some of the stuff we ordinarily talk about. But this is a very special time in your life and fantastic to have access to you because you are retiring. Do you use the R word? What are you doing?
I suppose I'm readjusting. That might be a best word. I'm moving on. I'm leaving my position in Letterkenny University Hospital where I've been for 18 years. I'm well past retirement age, so I think it's good to just look at new opportunities and allow younger people to come into the hospital, breathe new life into it. So, yes, if you want to use the word retiring, yes, but I'm going to relocate and re-adventure up to Pauline.
And you have that space now to do it.
Yes, so from next week, I'll no longer be working in the hospital. I came in 2008 and I've been there for 18 years and it's been a fantastic journey.
But your whole life is kind of a fantastic journey and we'll meander our way back to Letterkenny eventually. Originally from Galway, what's your early memories of Galway?
Yes, well, my father was a banker. You know, he was the old Munster and Leinster Bank, the Allied Irish banks. And we moved as a family. We started in Waterford, going to Tipperary, to Carlow. And most of my life was in Galway. So I really consider myself a Galwegian growing up in Salt Hill. Agus Cuig Mé Gcuidí Cláisteanna, where we did most of our subjects in Irish. And that was an interesting experience. I went to university at the age of 16 to UCG and started my medical training, qualifying in 1981, and was thrust upon the community. So that's where my journey in medicine started.
And just for those who don't know, and I count myself amongst them, do you specialise through your education in medicine or what would you qualify as? And then how do you progress in whatever your chosen field might be if it hasn't been chosen already?
Well, in those days, it was 6 years training and that gave you a broad exposure to medicine, surgery, obstetrics, ENT, all the main disciplines, paediatrics. And I suppose during your training, Greg, you get to appreciate the different nuances of different subspecialties, and you may want to do family practice as a significant number one GP or family practice. For me, it was surgery. And from my 3rd year in college, I always wanted to be a surgeon. I think different personalities, you know, do different things. They say that the paediatricians are the most balanced of all medical people. Perhaps the surgeons are a bit more feisty. That's how I ended up doing surgery.
Now, say, for instance, if you decided to take up darts or golf, and I ask these questions of sports people sometimes, how much of it's learned and how much of it do you have to have an ability? So in terms of surgery, it feels like it's incredibly precise. You must require, I would imagine, great patience. Like, is that, do you have to have certain skill set that you're born with that you can hone, or is it something that if you dedicate enough time to, you can train up to?
Yes, I think there's certainly both elements are important. I think that you probably have intrinsic qualities that make you more surgically orientated. For me, it's rather bizarre because Pauline wouldn't let me near a wall with a Black and Decker. So my skills with a screwdriver and a nail are very limited, but I would hope that my surgical skills are completely different. So I think that you actually have to have a training to learn the skills. Intrinsically, I think you have a coordination ability that is important. And then the way your mind thinks would probably direct you to individual areas within, say, surgery or medicine.
As someone who works in the field of making people better, trying to prolong life, unfortunately, having to inform people perhaps that they have less time than they anticipated, how do you deal with that, or how do you cope with that? Is that something you ever come to terms with, or?
Yes, you do come to terms with it, Greg, as you progress through your medical training. There are times you can never come to terms with it. And it is very difficult to see people pass and die. And the initial stages of your younger years as a junior doctor or NCHD or a trainee, it actually can be quite traumatic. But it depends on who it is that's dying. I mean, if you have an older patient in their 80s who's had a good life, there is that kind of understanding that they're moving on to the next phase, which...
And you know, nothing you could do could prolong their life beyond a certain...
Yes, but it can be extremely traumatic to see a young person die. And, you know, no matter what age you are, even someone, you know, who's had the lifelong time in medicine, there are particularly traumatic events.
And how have you dealt with them throughout your career? Have you spoken about it? Have you bottled it up? Have you compartmentalized it? Did you ever avail of supports that might be available within the HSC?
Well, I think it's a different time in medicine now than when I was training. I think there are much better supports for people. Mm. When I was training, you did the best you could. I never would have thought of getting any help or support. You compartmentalized it. You grew to understand it, and you dealt with it. Mm. I think that a lot of doctors, for example, when it comes to funerals and people who pass on and friends, perhaps have that mechanism, they block this out.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Does something within you have to blunt to some extent?
Most definitely, Greg, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to manage. Mm. So if you were to take on the grief that a family takes on, you couldn't do your day-to-day work. You know, you wouldn't be able to cope with this, Greg. So inherent in your treatment of patients, some who die of cancer, heart attacks, or maybe involved in physical injury and trauma, you really have to be able to put it aside, keep a professional, not saying not sympathetic, but you have to have yourself at a different level.
Mm. And then I suppose the other end of it, you know, when someone comes in, maybe it's a complex case or maybe you realize you can do something that can prolong this person's life to their natural life, that sense of that gift. And anytime you're on with us, we are contacted by people who believe that you gave them a gift of life. Is there something to cope with there?
Yeah, that is the really rewarding side of the job. To be able to help people is a fundamental thing in medicine. And I think that it's about a team. And, I would work within a team, and it is the team that come together to get this patient through what can be otherwise the end of their life. Mm. And there are different times when this happens. So it may be somebody who has been in a car crash. It could be someone with a burst gallbladder or a perforated bowel who may only have, you know, 24 hours to live if they're not managed properly. And then you have the cancer patients it's a very traumatic time for them. It's all about the team. So some are more obvious that you potentially have saved this patient's life, and others are part of a teamwork that works together in a system. But it's wonderful to see the patients come through and to see their families, their partners, their kids. And that is so rewarding.
I think it's the children element of it that would be, I can only imagine what it must be like, but to be able to, give someone the opportunity to be there for their children, to see their children grow, to maybe attend those milestones.
Yes.
It's almost greater than the gift of life. Almost it's the fullness of a life. Like.
Yes, and it is very traumatic when you meet someone, Greg, who's been diagnosed, say, with cancer, as I would have many times, especially when they're young and they're worried. We know there's great hope in the management with the team, both oncology, radiation oncology, our nursing care, everyone coming together. But it is very traumatic on that first moment, telling young ladies in particular they have cancer. And it is very upsetting. I mean, I know I've been in tears a few times in the consultation room because I've been so upset for the lady. But that would be unusual. And each individual case is different.
Yeah, and I feel in that moment, whatever the outcome might be, you and their lives are intertwined forever.
They are. And they're eternally grateful when they come through and survive. And it's wonderful to see them, you know, 10, 15 years later. Mm. And some go on to have children. These are the younger ladies, and the older ladies go on to have their grandkids. And it's a lovely profession.
Right. So you qualified from University College Galway in 81, and then, which I wasn't aware of, and this is the great part of this conversation, because I'm learning things as we go, as I'm sure listeners are as well. You spent 20 years in Australia. So what age would you have been when you went to Australia, and what did you do when you got there?
Well, I qualified when I was 22. Having gone to college when I was 16, which was a bit young. I must have skipped a few years. I'm not sure what happened.
Didn't do transition year anyway.
There was no transition, no.
Or else your parents diddled your passport or your birth certificate.
Something like that. But so having, I got married in 84, and I spent 8 years training in Dublin and Limerick and Galway. And I did my fellowship in 86, Irish Surgical Fellowship. And then I decided, I didn't really have a family background of medicine. My father was a banker, and I decided, well, look, maybe I'll just go. And Pauline and myself and three lads went to Australia in 1989, knowing no one, with three suitcases. And I remember arriving in Adelaide with three black bags and three suitcases and three young kids. So that was quite an exciting time. I worked as a senior registrar, which is called a higher surgical trainee and fellow in Adelaide for 2 years, and then went to Brisbane for 1 year, and then ended up in my parent hospital in Sydney on the fourth year, where I stayed for 17 years.
And at that point, were you a breast surgeon?
I was a general surgeon. At those days, there were very few true breast surgeons. Mm. So I did general surgery. In Sydney, I did a lot of trauma surgery, and I did breast surgery. So I
and
did
what
three
was
things.
The, what would the consequences have been of in that time there not being necessarily dedicated breast surgeons?
I think that we relied in those days more on plastic surgeons to do the oncoplastic side, the reconstruction side. I think things have really come on with greater advances in breast surgery and oncology. And nowadays, most of the surgeons we appoint are specific breast surgeons who don't do emergency surgery generally. It depends on which hospital you're in.
Mm-hmm. And I presume that's better. They're specialists.
I think it is. I think that they can offer them specifically better options. Mm. So our new breast surgeon now will have in Letterkenny, will have the option to, you know, do implant reconstruction, which I wouldn't do. I would give to the plastic surgeons to do with them.
So were positions of dedicated breast surgeons established and you applied, or did you notice this is an area where you could make an impact and put yourself in the position for a role like this? Or how does that happen?
Yes, what happened was our children grew up in Australia. We had a fourth child in Australia, was born in Australia. And then we used to come back to Ireland every year.
Mm.
And they loved coming to their grandparents, and Pauline and I would bring them back nearly every year. They were in farmers mostly. And they had such a good time coming back to Ireland that they decided to come back to university in Ireland. And on the basis of that, after 17 years and all our kids were in Ireland, coming home.
There you go. Okay.
So what we did there, Greg, was having done breast surgery and general surgery, a position came up for a breast and general surgeon in Letterkenny. And that's how I ended up here in 2008.
And do you and Pauline make all decisions together, if you know what I mean, like in terms of initially going out to Australia and then coming home? I don't mean that in a very personal way, just as a curiosity.
That's an interesting question. I'm not quite sure who makes all the decisions in our house, but it's generally a joint decision.
Yeah.
And it was interesting. We never knew why we really went to Australia. It wasn't, maybe it was because of neighbours or something. I'm not quite sure. Yeah. But we ended up in Adelaide.
It was purely a choice. It wasn't driven by necessity necessarily.
It was a choice, yes. Now, Pauline was a radiographer, and she was in demand in Australia, more than I was as a doctor back in the day. So she actually ended up doing mammography. And she progressed through where we moved to Sydney. She was the chief mammographer for Southern Sydney. So she had a very high-profile job. And I was a surgeon in Southwest Sydney, which was the poorest part of Sydney, but an interesting part with very multicultural society.
And does the demographic of a community skew the type of work that you find yourself doing at all?
It does, yes. I think... When you have the more socioeconomically deprived areas, you tend to have greater complexity because people don't attend their doctors. So they often present late, more advanced disease. And I think they're probably a little bit more appreciative. They're more salt of the earth, so to speak.
Yeah. So you come home. And I want to get on to, by the way, it's just interesting to track your career, but you've published books. I know you have done an amazing job in photographing and platforming this beautiful county, and you love the outdoors. And I want to focus on that maybe as a separate conversation. But when you were in Australia, is this something came to you later in life, or throughout your life have you liked to explore the outdoors, the cycling, the rambling, the climbing?
Well, having had four lads, four boys, and I suppose Pauline had to deal with five boys, me being the oldest, we got up to great mischief. We used to cycle quite a bit. We'd walk. We really loved the outdoors, and Australia lent itself to that with kayaking.
And did you pursue those activities mostly with the boys?
Yes.
Which is lovely for you and lovely for them. It's not something we see all of the time.
Yes, well, our lads used to say, you know, they could at one stage joking, well, I don't know if they were exactly joking, that when they were in their teens that they couldn't invite anyone over because they didn't have a PlayStation to play with. but we weren't that cruel to them. They entertained themselves because they're very close in age, and... we just did like that. We loved the sea and the beach, and we'd spend many times, we'd go just to the beach and chill out.
Beautiful memories.
Yeah, lovely memories, yes.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Right, so you come home, the position comes up in Letterkenny. Is this where we find you now honing into your speciality?
Yes, I mean, I focused when I came back on breast and general surgery. I gave up trauma surgery, which I did in Sydney, and I suppose it was an opportunity to work with a great team in the hospital. And, you know, I worked with Catherine McGann and Connell as in radiology and the pathology, Jerry O'Dowd and the team. And it was just a wonderful time. We got busier and busier and busier. And then I was joined by Manvidas Varsagalis 8 years ago. So the unit was a lovely place to work with the staff. It was a very busy unit. Geraldine McGregor and kept me honest. She's the breast nurse, and I would always say she was my boss. And it was wonderful to work as a team. And Geraldine Crumley and Kira McCracken, and then we had Rosalind and Catherine and Kathleen and Nicola and Brenda. All came together.
Very interesting that you can name everybody so freely.
Well, it's very much. It was very much a dynamic unit, you know. We're all on the same floor. Mm. No real hierarchy as such.
And I want to focus on that a little bit more, but I know, in terms of research and innovation, something very important to you. And you developed the emergency abdominal surgery course. Is this whilst you were in Australia or in Letterkenny? Because this has become now a standard and is taught right across the world. So when were you working on that? And tell us a little bit of, I know it's for lay people, right? I'm a lay person, but just tell us a little bit about that and its significance.
Well, as a medical person, you really, I suppose in other trades as well, you actually want to teach people. So I've had an interest in teaching all my life. In Australia, we set up courses in around the world, actually. So when I came back here, the emergency workload was extremely busy, Greg. We're the fifth busiest emergency hospital in the country. And it was a unique opportunity to actually develop a new course that would train registrars initially. That we did in 2012. And I remember the first course, because we don't have a conference centre in the hospital. I remember going to the Silver Tassie, and we had a register on a boom microphone, and it was really interesting. And that was our first course. And since that time, we then progressed on to develop courses for medical students, for nurses, for consultants. And we now have four courses, which have taken in over 4,000 students, be them consultants, registrars, nurses, or medical students. And that's such a popular course. It involves the team. So when you're in medicine, you work with a team. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people forget, my God, there's a nurse on, you know, you work with a team. So this course is all about the team. It includes radiology, which are the X-ray people. It includes the gastroenterology, which are people who put scopes down your tummy and stop your bleeding or whatever. And that course has now been run in 13 countries in four continents. And it's universally regarded as one of the most enjoyable days that people who go to it say they've experienced in their medical career. So that's really rewarding. It is, yes. I suppose the important thing is, Greg, you know, you go to a course, it's about changing practice and performance. Mm.
So now people will know of your heavy involvement in the Northwest Breast Cancer Charity Ball, the importance of, you know, research, innovation, as we've been discussing. When you arrived here, it wasn't quite a blank canvas, was it? Or did you see an opportunity to start the process of building something? We're still on the journey to what that might be.
Yes.
But I'm just wondering, because you clearly became incredibly invested when you didn't necessarily have to be, I imagine.
Yes, well, you know, my heart is in Donegal and my soul will be here sometime soon. But, you know, it was an opportunity, given the volumes of people that we had coming through the hospital, to actually answer some key clinical questions. So what a group of us decided in 2010 was to develop a Donegal Clinical Research Academy, and that's still going. We wanted to have a building where we could have a conference room and research and education facilities. We have some education facilities in the hospital. We still don't have that conference room. The late Hugh Green, gave us a donation, which we had hoped would build an auditorium. We got planning permission for that, and I'm still in eternal hope that it will happen someday. In relation to the research, we started working with students, medical students, and each summer we would take on five medical students. Alison Johnson was appointed as the research coordinator, funded by funds like from the Breast Bowl, people's tea parties, Christmas lights, golfing outings, and the generosity of people from Donegal. During that 10-year period, it was a 7-year period, we had about 50 medical students who actually, 90% of them published a paper, which is pretty good for them to do that. And they got an exposure to research. We then had Professor William Campbell donate half his Nobel laureate winnings to the Donegal Clinical Research Academy.
Why was he moved to do that?
Because I asked him. So I had met him a couple of times. I'd met him in Remelton with John McAteer when he was just William Campbell.
Right.
We had a great chat, and I didn't realise that, you know, that he was going to win a Nobel Prize. But he was taken by the fact that he wanted to support Donegal, and he loved research. And he was, for someone to become the William Campbell Scholar, like, it's just an incredible thing on your CV as a young student. So he donated the funds, and we used to pay the students 200 euros or 250 euros a week so they could live. And they were just outstanding. Alison Johnson really worked well with them. And for many of them, some of them actually went into research in medicine after their terms here. But what it did was it answered a lot of questions. It actually improved the delivery of care. Like so much so, like say someone with appendicitis, we actually managed to improve our appropriate operations by unbelievable factors, working with the other surgeons. So we all worked together, but it was quite exciting time. And I had to stop that last year, and it's 2 years now since we've had a research student. But it was a wonderful thing. Also, registrars did work. We presented many papers internationally. In fact, the profile of the unit is it has a singular figure of being in the top 5% of Irish research for publications for a specific person. Okay,
that's quite impressive.
So it is really interesting. Anyway,
so the Charity Bowl, then the Northwest Breast Cancer Charity Bowl. How does this fit into all of this? Because this has become a mainstay on the calendar, and the most recent, of course, had the health minister up, which I think was a real strong indicator potentially of how Donegal had touched her, and the fact that she would have been aware that she'd have got a respectful audience as well too. Sometimes we don't always have that, right? But you need to keep these people relatively close to you. So talk to me about the significance to you of the Northwest Breast Cancer Charity Bowl.
Well, first of all good ideas come from Pauline, and I remember coming, and she said,
"I really should have brought Pauline in."
Yeah,
here
you
for
should
a
have
second.
Her in here instead of me. Yes, she's much more interesting. So, the Breast Cancer Bowl was really there to bring the community. You know, it is a great thing here in Donegal is that the community have an interlinkage with the hospital, certain aspects of the hospital anyway, that's really healthy. So the idea was really a celebration of survivors and an opportunity to raise some money, because there is no funding for research. In my entire 18 years, I have not received any health department or university. Well, we did get 2,000 euros from NUIG.
Bring out the marching bands.
Yeah, so we had to raise that money ourselves. And the Breast Bowl, on average, raises about 15,000 a year. So that's nearly 250,000 that was raised and used for research. And it's a night of a bit of fun. These have been fantastic. I led them for years. You know, we've had Betty and so many others and join in. So it's been a great night out, and people love it. So, and it brings money in for the research. So
I think it wins on so many different levels, yeah. Doesn't it? That it's really counterintuitive, isn't it, to sort of have people who are very keen and can prove the research, but not to fund it. Is that because we were overlooked, or is that just not a particular focus of the HSE?
Well, it isn't the focus of the HSE specifically, and I can understand this, Greg, because we have to provide clinical care.
Mm-hmm.
So the HSE has got to provide clinical care. But what is really good is if you can combine research with clinical care, it's a win-win situation. So in terms of this, if you identify optimal care, then look at it and see is it being implemented, you can then actually improve delivery of care. So it should be hand in hand. But I can understand how people want delivery of care.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more important than research. But they do go hand in hand, and they make a huge difference.
Yeah. In terms of your efforts to improve the situation in Letterkenny, and most recently, you know, your campaign, and it's not just a campaign, sorry, but actually you're articulating the argument for Letterkenny to be a Model 3, the delivery of a surgical hub. Back in the day, it was fighting for breast surgeons, working with hospital campaigners, right? So we could never, I don't think we would ever have time enough to really give your efforts the credit that they deserve. Because you were also doing this whilst being a family man, enjoying some of your hobbies, which we'll get to, but also actually being an incredibly busy surgeon. How have you balanced all of that over the years?
I think I probably have an issue with fairness, Greg. Mm. I don't know what part of my brain it affects, but I fundamentally can't stand unfairness. And it's a matter of principle. It's a matter of principle where why should we not receive the same opportunity? Now, we have to accept, Greg, that Letterkenny is geographically removed from Dublin, and there are services we can never have, nor should we ever have here. But for basic services, we need to be funded to the same degree. And I suppose when I worked in Sydney, I saw working in the most deprived area of southwest Sydney, where the original population was about 120,000, rising to 350,000, I could see that the hospital, Liverpool University Hospital, was really neglected. Mm-hmm. And through a whole activity and change of plan, it's now the biggest hospital in Australia.
So that's what can be achieved.
It can be achieved. Now, obviously, Letterkenny is not going to be no. St. James's or anything like that, but it was just wonderful to see that transition, and it's now a leader in so many areas of medicine. So in Letterkenny, working with the team of, you know, 15 consultants and some nursing staff and other team members, we really began to feel that this isn't right. And to actually bring that to the fore, you need the facts. And the facts sometimes can be embarrassing.
And I just on that, and I want you to continue, there are obviously a couple of ways that you can achieve what you wish to achieve. Deputies can support you in the Dáil and make very strong arguments, and 102 or 300 people can march around the border of the hospital with placards. But perhaps one of the most boring elements, but the most critical elements, is actually making a legitimate argument, which is what you undertook. And as I say, the detail which you would have put together would be far too complex for me, or perhaps most people listening. But to point out the differences between this hospital, the other hospital, the demographic, you know, the arguments for and against, and here, and that has been critical. That's been really, really critical, as well as the pressure in any advancements we're seeing right now. Would you agree?
Yes, I think the most important thing is you have to have the facts and you have to have the evidence to support your case. And I hope that the Model 3 report, which I worked on with a team, and it was part of my job, Greg. It wasn't.
No, I understand.
It was part of my job. I hope when that is published, and it will be published, I have no doubt, and it hopefully will be published soon, the people will be able to understand the facts behind the situation. And when that is published, it will become clear the course of action that is required to address the inequality. So,
How optimistic are you for the future of Letterkenny University Hospital? Because, of course, you know, there's an awful lot going on in different areas of the hospital, and we know we've got the community hospital coming on stream. The HSC is committing to, you know, to have the funding for more home care packages, home care hours, etc. So there's different strands going off in all different directions, with a view to hopefully bringing the hospital to a point whereby, I mean, hospitals, acute hospitals are designed really to run at capacity, aren't they? Or close there to it, right? But where are we now, and how optimistic are you when all of these different things that I've mentioned, plus the hub, plus the injuries clinic, etc., come online? How optimistic are you?
I'm very optimistic, Greg. Very optimistic. And I'm fundamentally optimistic because of the volume of people in Donegal. So that in itself can't go away. Mm-hmm. You have 180,000 people. They need treatment. We're not a Port Iancla, we're not a Wexford. We haven't got a necklace of 6 to 8 hospitals in our region that we can go to at ease. So the actual facts have been listened to by the minister and the politicians. So they have rallied around. They now understand the situation we're in. The minister understands it. And I think her decisions last July really gave us hope. I believe for almost the first time, real hope, because she is a leader and she has made these decisions that there has to be equity.
And also what has to happen in these situations, there has to be a motion set in chain. And we are sitting in planning permissions. We did recently see, as we record this, the 2026 budget having some provision for some of the developments we're talking about. So the wheels are in motion. So if Micheál Martin or whomever it is decided to have a cabinet reshuffle, someone would have to reverse the decisions. There's enough progress that it's, as much as anything, can be locked in.
Yes. So the things that we've, the big picture items that we've recently received are the surgical hub, 100 million. We've received oncology enhancement, so badly needed. And the minister has given a commitment to the development control plan, which is worth 400 to 500 million. So these are three key things. If you add into that recent appointments, we have a new breast surgeon just started this week. How fantastic is that? Second breast radiologist. You know, that's just one service. If we go to the trainee, you know, the foremen, so to speak, under the gov, these are higher surgical. That's what I was when I went to Australia, if you remember that part of the conversation. Mm-hmm. They've just doubled the number of trainees. You know, the facts show that we're completely underdone. So the medical training bodies in Ireland have doubled the number of trainees. So this is really, really important, Craig, because it allows the foremen, and I use the word foremen, it could be four women, but it's so important to the hospital. So the infrastructure is going to improve, and we're having a number, increased number of applications for positions. So I'm very optimistic.
And success breeds success.
And it does.
And it becomes more attractive. Just one question on that before we move on. It's always difficult. We face this on the radio program as well, whereby you need to highlight certain things, but at the same time, we know everyone's got Google, right? So you don't want to be doing the very thing you're trying to enhance and improve and save a disservice. Have you found that a tricky line to walk, whereby you want to build something that people want to come to, but in doing so, you don't want to put it down to the extent they don't?
Yes. Well, that's very important. And the reality is, if you're giving a negative message about a service, the problem in Donegal is you have to travel 3 to 5 hours to get a replacement service. And we just can't afford to have people doing that, Greg. I mean, some people, of course, the esophageal cancers, the pancreatic cancers, of course, they're going to have to go to Dublin, and there are specialist treatments that we can't give here. So, unfortunately, we need to ensure, despite it being unpalatable at times, that the service improves. And it's only through speaking out and just sharing the facts. And I'm so grateful to the politicians cross-party, and so are the group in the hospital, that they came on board along with our colleagues in primary care. I mean, it's never happened in Ireland, to my knowledge, that this group came together. And that's very positive, and that will never
and
go away.
And the GPs being in there,
yes,
as
that's
well.
Primary critical. Care, yes.
Yeah,
yep.
It's just not everyone knows the terminology. That was quite an amazing, to get everyone pulling in the same direction, really, really quite remarkable, and something that can't be ignored. And I think that's why things are progressing as they are progressing. Just curiously, you know, like, when anyone has an issue with the health service, let's just use Letterkenny University Hospital, often it's nothing to do with the staff, and they will often say, listen, the staff were fantastic, right? Or when we're talking about issues relating to the hospital, my motivation is to support staff, right? To try and say, we're here with you, we appreciate what you're doing, we know everyone can't speak out. You have to get to a certain stage, really, I think, of your career before you can feel confident in doing so. Do the staff get that we're on their side, do you think? And I'm not saying me and you, but I do wonder sometimes, like, I have a lot of contact with staff within the hospital, and they give me feedback, but then I hear sometimes, like, well, you know, Greg's always running the place down.
Yes, it's a very hard thing to do. You know, in a unit situation that I work in, the people know they're doing a fantastic job. We do make mistakes occasionally, but we get over it. It's very hard in big organizations to show appreciation. Very hard. Mm-hmm. And I think we could do that an awful lot better, Greg, right in the health service. people are very busy. They're stressed. And I think, yes, that's something that needs to be done far better than we currently do.
Your wife, when you both of you come back here, because I know she's a foodie and runs courses and is incredibly passionate about that, was she able to sort of move away from medicine off the bat at home and focus on that?
Yeah, well, she's quite remarkable, really, because we were old Café Blend on the first week we came back in 2008.
That was a cafe that you, Pauline, run.
Yes. Well, we took that over from Barry and Andrea Nocton and Cliff and Deirdre, who had run it for, I think, about 6 years. And we're having a coffee there one day, and Pauline wanted a job as a mammographer, but there was no job.
Right.
So she said, look, she had no experience apart from being a great cook. And she just took over that and ran it for 8 years. And I was very much Pauline's husband in Letterkenny. I mean, people, yeah, well, that's Pauline's husband. Because she had that wonderful way with food and flavours.
And people, obviously.
Yes. And I think it was a mixture of the Asian-Australian cuisine, which probably hadn't been really seen a lot in Donegal at the time. And that was wonderful. So having spent 8 years at that, she then decided, I need a break from that, and decided to go to Ballymaloe. So she did a remarkable in-house 3-month course, which it was a wonderful educational opportunity where she went through, I think they go through about 1,800 recipes in their time. Remarkable education.
It's intense, isn't it?
Yeah, it's very intense. But, and then she set up Wild Garlic Table. And
that's in Remelton.
That's in Remelton. Everything happens in Remelton.
I know. It's astonishing. For such a small place, the history and its people, and it punches so much above its weight.
Yeah.
Now, onto your passions. Outdoors, we've talked to them, cycling. But yeah. I'm curious about how Donegal found itself so deep in your soul, or in your heart. You know, when obviously you're dealing with the people, and it is beautiful, but there seems to be a connection between you and the county, you and the region, that goes sort of beyond, I like living here, right? It seems to be on a different level. So what clicked and when did it click?
Well, I think, you know, the people are just amazing. As a Galway man, and having spent my life in big cities, particularly in Sydney, to come to an environment where you say hello to everyone. And it's funny when you go to Dublin, you have to stop saying hello to everyone in the street. You know, it's kind of funny. Yeah, certainly at the airport, you know,
you're on the Lewis, and you're nodding at people, and they're looking like you're crazy.
Yes. So I remember, you know, people coming into the hospital. And I said, look, by the time you go in the front door or out the back door, you've probably said hello to about 20 people. But anyway, I think the people are truly remarkable, and that was the thing I really enjoyed most. Or enjoy most, is the nature of the Donegal person is rather unique. They're welcoming. They're at times they're funny. They're inquisitive, and they know what's going on. And it would be quite interesting. People would say occasionally to Pauline in the cafe, "Does the wallpaper go the whole way down in your front sitting room?" Or occasionally you'd say, "There's a bulb gone in your chandelier in your front room," or whatever. Donegal people are very easy to deal with. So from a job point of view, it was a remarkable thing. And then it grew from there. Pauline went to Ballymaloe, and that left me 3 months kind of loose. And I decided to spend more time in the outdoors and took up some photography, which I'd had an interest in since I was in school.
Well, you must have, because and anyone who's seen your book would realise that you have a knack for it. So it couldn't have just been picked up while Pauline was out thrashing her way through 1,800 menus.
Yes. Well, it's something, you asked me about surgery at the start, it's something you learn. And it's funny, when I did my first book, it was completely unedited because I didn't know anything about editing. And then the second book, I had bought Lightroom and I altered the tones a little bit. And hopefully when my third book comes out, well, I'll have used more knowledgeable features. So I love going out. Pauline and I would love to go out. We cycle a lot and we would walk a lot. We have two dogs, two golden retrievers.
Which are interestingly named.
Errigal and Muckish. So, yes, it's really interesting. I, I wanted to share with your listeners some of my favorite walks and some of the things. And
yeah, sure.
I brought my book along, Greg. So I just put some highlights there just to share with you.
Yes, we'll have to be verbally descriptive as well in this regard.
Yeah.
So both of these, we both have the same bookmarks, right?
Yes, okay. This is Donegal Atlantic Way.
Now, this is the first mark here, and we'll explain the book in a moment. The first mark here is, I think, one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And I always love driving to Dunloe, or what it's normally Dunloe I'm going to. And you look down to your left.
Yes.
And there's this scene out, like something Hollywood couldn't create.
Yes. Well, the Poison Glen, generally, the whole area, and I use that term, the Poison Glen, is a remarkable area. So if only your listeners could get out more. I mean, everyone goes up Errigal, and I call them the...
As you do.
Yes, the posh steps. And the sunset is better than the sunrise. And it's easy to get down now, Greg. The Donegal County Council has done a remarkable job.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have the muck and the thing. So you can actually do it in sneakers. You do need a headlight a little bit if you're going to stay for the full sunset. But looking over West Donegal towards Torrey with that sun going down, it is truly one of the most remarkable sunsets. You don't have to go to Santorini.
Mm.
You just have to come to Donegal. Mm-hmm. So the Poison Glen, left side, you've got the old Dunluce Church, and you can meander along up the Poison Glen. It's quite a remarkable place.
Mm-hmm.
Probably one of my favourite spots is Loch Alton, which many people don't know about.
Where is Loch Alton? Is that in... It is absolutely beautiful. Yeah. Again, it looks like New Zealand or Jurassic Park, or it's just... Beautiful.
So that's on page 99 of my book. There's just a sample. Down in the bottom of this lake, which is in total isolation, in the foothills of Errigal and Little Errigal, Ogla Bjog and Ogla Moor on the right-hand side as you look at it, you've got this remarkable walk. You can go off the main road. There's a little sign, and you go down 3 kilometres to a lake. And at the lake, there's this desolate castle.
What is that building? That is a castle,
isn't
it?
Yeah, it's a small...
It's really caught your eye, hasn't it? Because
you've
pictured it in a number of angles.
Yes. I have one of those photographs. It's probably my favourite photograph. It's a black and white photograph of all my photographs because it's so eerie and it's so natural. I mean, you can go in the summertime, you can swim in the lake, you can have the waterfall. There are always some sheep there. But Loch Alton is probably one of the most spectacular walks in Donegal.
Mm.
And very few people know about
it. I haven't heard about it before.
Yeah. You do need, in wet weather, you do need high shoes, okay? Mm. Unlike Errigal, you can do Errigal in any gear.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you know, it might have been quite easy for you in your book, even though it's not, it's for an international audience, but to skip over the obvious, right? You've got Glenveagh too.
Yeah.
Glenveagh Castle. And do you know what I love about going there is actually the people that work there. They're fantastic. But it really is, and they're doing amazing work. There's people working on things in that they will never see come to fruition. A 100-year plan to try and, you know, to have that commitment to do work so hard, something that you have to just imagine will come to pass. But anyway, sorry, I'm rambling. Yeah. Talk to me about
There are hidden parts of Glenveagh.
Yes.
Okay? So the standard front up car park and entry, and it's truly remarkable.
I know what you mean.
Absolutely beautiful. Yeah. But you need to go further.
Yes.
Okay, so you need to go past the castle and the bridle path on page 120 here. You can see this is from the top of Ascalon Waterfall. And you're looking down at that meandering river, but there's a little path that goes the whole way up for 6 kilometres up to the back. So you can actually do almost a 10-kilometre walk there, and you can cycle it, but it is truly spectacular.
Okay.
And most people only get to the castle, which, as you say, is remarkable. So. Mm.
But don't let that be your final destination.
No, keep going.
Port. What's
Port?
Port.
Yeah, Port. Port. That is a hidden gem. It's down in southwest Donegal, and it really is.
Where's it near?
Glencolum Kill is to the south of it. So
okay, you're really going deep into the west. Yeah.
So you can actually go right across the headland up across Glenloch Bay and it's total isolation.
I was going to ask you what drew you to it, and is it pure isolation?
Yes, you're just there with nature, and you've got some sheep, you've got the most scenic areas. It's just absolutely remarkable. You can go left or right. You can go down to Glencolumkill, or you can go right or up as far as Maharorty. So yeah,
Burton Port. I love Burton Port.
Yeah,
Hayter Island is where you've. Love that part of the. I just love. Is it topography? Is that how you? Is that the right word? I just love it. I find myself now living in Downings, and it is the similar feel to it.
Yes.
I get a sense of, I just love it. I love the island, and I love getting out to the island, and I love getting to Burton Port.
Yeah.
And I'm delighted that we're talking a little bit about that.
Yes.
Why? And this is an interesting picture here that you've taken. And again, we'll have to explain for listeners in that is it panoramic?
Yeah, this is a panoramic stitched photograph with 12 shots in it. But what I'm standing on Hayter Island, so I've actually kayaked out to Hayter, which you do from Burton Port. And if you want to kayak in Donegal, it is truly remarkable. Now, all these sea colours are unedited, and it's aqua greeny blue. It is fairly calm, and you can actually kayak over to Aran Mór. So it's probably one of the nicest parts of Ireland to kayak in.
There's a lovely picture, actually, of Aran Mór, the blue boat on the edge of the rope.
Yeah.
And what I like about that is the time, because it takes a long time, not as long as you might think, it takes a long time for that seaweed and that light to gather on that rope, because it's pulled and it slacks. And
yes.
It's pulled and it's slacked. And it's a beautifully framed photo. Lovely picture.
Yeah, so it's West Donegal is an amazing place. I mean,
be careful now, because we're going to Remelton next. Okay,
so but it's hard to pick a favourite spot from a photographic point of view. Fanard Lighthouse is truly
that's the apple of your eye
from a photographic point of view. I mean, it is an end destination. And you have so many angles. I mean, it's an internationally recognised as being one of the most beautiful lighthouses in the world. And you've got the White Strand aspect. You've got the small pebbly beach. Mm-hmm. You can go on a tour there as well if you're interested. They have a wonderful new gift shop and coffee shop, which is really lovely.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really a must do, especially if you've got visitors coming who don't want to walk.
Yes, but I think it was either your first or second book we were chatting, and this is going back quite some time, but it stuck in my head a little bit about how the county changes, right? So if you visit a lot of the places that we're talking of at different times of the day, different times of the year, different seasons of the year, your experience is different. Like that picture you've taken of Burton Port and the natural colours and all that type of stuff, you go out there on Sunday and you get a completely different picture, even though the subject's effectively the same. And that's one of the things that's, I think, about our region.
Yeah, and what is, in addition to that, Greg, we're one of the few places where low tide, it's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Because on the East Coast, you don't want to be there at low tide.
No, yeah.
Different
type of...
Yeah, so really Donegal opens up at low tide.
Bit of pressure on you to sort of capture what you wish to capture about Remelton, or... So say, for instance, in these pictures you take from Remelton or wherever you take them from, but particularly Remelton because that's where you are living. Is it about a beautiful picture, or are you also trying to tell a story in a picture?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, a picture, you've got your standard picture, but the picture has to have something in it. There has to be a meaning in it, or there has to be more than one feature. So there is a wow photograph and then there's a nice photograph. Now, the wow photograph to me has to have at least two or three elements in it. It has to either have the sun with a reflection or an angle. So pure beauty to me isn't enough. It's a funny concept. So you're trying to catch an angle. You're trying to catch a reflection or a light. Or
well, so in the picture on page 187 of Remelton, I'm not sure what the technique is, but you've sort of captured the brake lights of a vehicle.
Yes.
Right. What is that demonstrating? Is that just fitting into the festive scene? Could we imagine that Santi on his way, right? Or is there another tale in there?
Well, I suppose it's motion. So in a static picture, you're introducing the concept of motion. And the motion in this case is a red streaky light going through Remelton. So they're the Christmas lights, which people work so hard on.
So this is a considered purchase, right? And also it has raised significant funds. But when you were designing it, to produce it at this size, to produce it with the picture quality, it costs quite a bit of money. Why did you decide that this was the way it needed to be? Because these, I've got one of these sitting on in an important space at home, and people pick it up and they glance through it and they put it down. It's that type of a thing, right? Was that your vision?
Yes. I think this book cost $33,000 to produce.
Mm.
It's produced in Ireland, so it's printed and bound in Ireland. I think that if you're doing something, it has to be special. And I'm so grateful. This was supported by a number of key industries, Donegal County Council, and it raised, between this and the other book, about $50,000 for charity. I didn't personally make any money out of it. It was for charity. So to do something that people can give to their relatives or can remind them of Donegal or inspire them to get out and do some walking, or it's something nice, and it's something I'll always savour.
So depending on when people listen to this, you're either about to leave Letterkenny University Hospital or you left. You may have left a year ago if they don't listen to it for a while, right? But it's March 12th, 2026. Again, I imagine, do we know whether it's your decision or Pauline's decision, or is it this harmony that both of you seem to have? What is the plan? As much as you want to divulge. You've already told a few people, so.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take a break for a few days anyway, just joking. No, I will take a break and get some fresh air. I'm going to take up a position as a professor of surgery for teaching in the university in Penang in Malaysia.
That's huge.
Yeah, well, it's going to fulfill another passion in my life, which is teaching.
Okay.
So I'm looking forward to that. And that's a joint venture between UCD and the Royal College of Surgeons in Ireland.
And how does something like that come about?
It came about by chance, actually. I was at a meeting in Galway, and I was approached by somebody who said, would you be interested in doing some teaching there? And I suppose when you've travelled to the other side of the world, Malaysia is only two-thirds to Australia, so it's an opportunity.
How will the work-life balance be in terms of your love of outside, your opportunity to explore more?
Yeah.
I presume you don't want to be working as hard as you did here. Have you managed to negotiate a decent work-life balance for yourself?
I'm sure it'll be good, Greg.
This opportunity, did it speed up your departure?
No, I stayed an extra year to ensure that the breast unit was going to be viable.
And do you leave content in that?
Absolutely.
What are you most proud of? I'm going to exclude family, if that's okay.
Well, that would be impossible. I'm just proud that Pauline hasn't thrown me out after 43 years.
Yes, of course, that's an achievement for any of us. But I think it sounds like you're very well matched. What are you most proud of in terms of your career? Be it Australia, be it as a student, be it as an innovator, be it as a breast surgeon or a campaigner. I mean, you probably wouldn't see yourself as a campaigner, more as an articulator.
I suppose I'm proud that I still care.
Mm. What were you like to work with?
Awful little.
Yeah?
Oh, Jesus, I was.
Why, moody, cranky, fussy?
I'd be all right.
And these are all negative things. Yes, it might have been some really positive.
No, but I one thing about me, Greg, is I knew I was an awful devil.
Mm.
So people who worked with me, I would like to think most of them enjoyed working with me. People who didn't work with me would find me tricky. Sorry, I think maybe I'm exaggerating.
Yeah, but you clearly give 100%. Would it frustrate you when those around you don't share your passion or don't feel like you don't feel like they're giving 100%?
Yes, I mean,
it's very hard when you're passionate about something to work with people. And I'm not talking about anybody currently or in the past or anything. I'm just wondering sometimes, you know, when you care so much about something, I care so much about what I do. When people who are working with me, and thankfully it's not the case, but when they don't care as much as I do, that would be the hardest thing for me to be around.
Yes, I suppose there is two kind of divergent areas in my life. One is the patient, and the other would be other things in the hospital. Okay. So if it related to a patient, there was no boundaries. It was 100%. If it related to other things, well, you know, I didn't get, you know, I'd be a bit upset, but I wouldn't be 100%. So when it came to patients, I was very consistent.
And that's what matters, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, other great people work with you and, you know, they make it happen.
Have you any regrets?
Many.
Too few to mention.
I could have used more sunscreen when I was younger.
Okay. We all could use more sunscreen.
I suppose, you know, you could smile a bit more.
I think if that's the space we're in about regrets, you're not doing too bad.
I know. One has many regrets in life, but I feel it's been a wonderful opportunity that I've had in my life. And I did medicine because my father told me I had to do medicine. I wanted to become a banker. And the reason I ended up in medicine was my dad said I had to do medicine. And I remember going into the interview for pre-med and the professor of obstetrics, the late Professor Adwar, asking me why was I going to do medicine. And for some strange, bright moment, I said, I didn't say my father told me I had to. But no, it's been a wonderful career in medicine.
But also, too, it's so exciting, I'm sure I can imagine, to, you know, I used the R word at the start in the full knowledge of where the conversation was going to end up going. But to have this new exciting project, to be fulfilling something else that you want to do, but to be doing it with the opportunity of meeting a whole new group of people, potentially a completely different culture, to be able to absorb yourself in that, to be able to whip the camera out and start a new photographical journey. It must be lovely, and to have your health and to do so.
Well, it is very lucky, and it's very lucky that, you know, Pauline and my lads are very supportive. And, you know, there's opportunities, you know, for Pauline to get new flavours and bring back some...
Her spice rack is going to get considerably broader, I think.
You know, it's an adventure. We have two children in Australia, so we'll be a little bit nearer to them.
Yeah.
And that's kind of nice too, you know. So an exciting time ahead. Mm. And we've really enjoyed being here, and Pauline and I will continue to be here.
Yes, I know. Yeah. It's going to be a big change for a lot of people used to seeing you, what can you tell people to reassure them, those listening, such as the relationship and connection you've had with people in the community, that in some way, you know, things aren't going to go to pieces once you're no longer there?
Yes. My replacement, I am so delighted that she is joining the staff, and she is very experienced, and that is fantastic. I feel so relieved and so happy. Mm. We have, as I say, a second breast radiologist who's delightful, and we've now got two key aspects of the breast unit secured. So I'm very happy. I'm very happy for the people of Donegal, and I know they will get a better deal in the years ahead.
It's been a wonderful conversation. Anything you want to say before we wrap up?
I just want to thank the people of Donegal who have been so good to Pauline and myself. It's just been wonderful living here. And I feel, in a way, that the isolation, the lack of the motorways, the lack of the train, perhaps that's contributed to the wonderful environment we have. It just means that many other people haven't had the chance to experience it.
Well, we've very much enjoyed this conversation, of course, but also our conversations over the years. And a big thank you, Michael, for everything that you've done for the hospital. And, of course, then that means for the people and for the staff and for all the GPs and people working in different areas of healthcare, because the stuff that we see and the stuff that we haven't seen but will come out and will make this very hard to argue argument for the progression of Letterkenny University Hospital. It's a wonderful legacy to leave behind you if you see it as a legacy. But, you know, your fingerprints are all over the place and will be for generations to come.
I'm going to read a poem to you, Craig.
Please.
And this is Blood, Sweat and Tears. It's related to an image of a Boston ivy leaf that goes green, and then as the life of cycle goes, it goes red. Blood, sweat and tears, life's colourful cycle. Winter trunks like embryonic skeletons, awakened by warm spring southerlies. Enthusiastic buds sprouting like chicks from a nest. Leaves reincarnated from winter's slumber. Wax surfaces smooth, hungry for summer sun. Trunks now hidden by youthful plumage. Cooler autumnal air arriving, unannounced. Colors red and pleading for permanency. The leaf's pale, exhausted hilum, anemic. Veins more visible, brittle, sclerotic. Pristine edges, now jagged and darkening. Irregular holes appearing, struggling to respire. Breaths impossible. Beaded sweat coalescing. Glistening tears shed on foliage below. The elder leaf's body cleansed before its final gracious fall into the abyss. Thank you, Craig.
And on that note, we'll leave it. Mr. Michael Sugar, thank you very much. And a big thank you once again to Mr. Michael Sugar. And wish him all the best as he heads off on his new adventure. Okay, that was the Greg Hughes podcast for this week. Don't forget, we release new episodes every Friday at 11 a.m. and often bonus episodes during the week. Any feedback or suggestions, you can send them to our researcher and producer, Caroline Orr. Her email address, caroline.orr@highlandradio.com. But until we chat again, see ya.